So, Bob, let's answer emails. What do you say?
Yeah.
So, this first email is from an anonymous patron. She says, you recommended Love's Executioner by Irvin Yalom on the podcast, and I'm currently reading it, and it's fantastic. Thank you for the recommendation. However, as a fat woman, I'm struggling a bit with the chapter called Fat Lady.
Yeah.
While it's got some wonderful gems, it's also a bit... It's a bit of a rough read for me. It's rife with Yalom's jokes and observations about Betty's body all the way to the end of the chapter. I guess I'm wondering if you would be willing to share your thoughts on some of the things discussed in the chapter, like countertransference, stigma against fat people, or how obesity is discussed, categorized, pathologized in the world of psychology. Bob, what do you think?
Yeah, I haven't read that book in a long, long time, and... What I remember appreciating about that chapter was his willingness to own his own bias and, you know, prejudice. But I think if I could reread it now through the eyes of, you know, the growth of the last 25 years, I'd probably see it differently. And I could imagine rereading it and thinking Irv went far, but not far enough. So I don't want to defend him, like, and I don't want to, you know, but I just, that's all I remember is appreciating that he was at least, as he was writing, he was at least owning some of his bias. And that's the thing I like about that book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember that chapter personally. I read it at least a few times in the past, but yeah. I can't recall, but I guess the only thing I'll add is that for young people out there, whatever fat phobia and the prevalence of fat jokes you see in culture today was 100 times worse 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It was just open season on fat people. Sure. In the past. You could do whatever you wanted to.
Right.
You could just openly ridicule them in movies and television.
Right.
In person, on the street.
Yeah.
It was really awful. It's still bad, but it was really bad in the past.
Yeah.
Going on with another email here, anonymous patron. He says, I wanted to hear from the hosts, specifically Bob.
Oh,
that's good, because you're here.
It's a good thing I'm here.
About the contrasting emotions you feel after a breakup. I've been going through a divorce. I was with my wife for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've been with her since I was 20. Mm. She wanted a divorce back in April. I wanted to stay together, though. Why she wanted to leave me was confusing to me. But overall, I think she just fell out of love with me. And as she started to grow as a person, what she wanted from me and the relationship had changed. Also, she said I wasn't manly enough for her, which opened up some old insecurities for me.
Ouch.
I keep vacillating back and forth. Well, first off, what do you think of that bit?
Well, it's the problem with it is it's judgmental, and it's in what they call that? It shifts the locus of control onto the man. I don't think that's useful. I don't think it gives information, but it alienates and hurts. And of course, you know, you can't unring that bell. That one's going to rattle around in the head, especially if there's already a, you know, raw spot there around it, which, you know, I think for a lot of us there is. Men, the, you know, sort of sense of manliness is, you know, kind of a vulnerable spot.
Mm-hmm.
So, ouch. And unfortunately, we don't really know what the hell she meant.
Mm-hmm. Hard to know what she meant by that. I'm sure, anonymous patron, you have a lot more details, but there's a wide range of possibilities. And it's also possible that she didn't actually say or even think that you're not manly enough. She just said that you were not assertive and you interpreted it as manly. But if it was some statement of your manhood, that's despicable.
Yeah.
You can certainly break up with someone and say, I'm breaking up with you because you're not confident or you're not assertive or you don't want to have sex enough. You know, whatever sort of association that we have with, quote unquote, what it means to be a man.
Right.
You don't earn enough money or you don't dominate conversations. I don't know. Or you don't fix cars and house things.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think what else one could criticize someone, a husband, as saying you're not manly enough.
You don't fart enough. You don't drink enough beer. You don't watch enough football. You don't.
Yeah. So you can criticize based on your preference. I would like to be with a partner that did X, Y, and Z.
Sure.
As you say, locus of control. It's more her saying, yep, I want to be with someone like that. And when you're not like that, it affects me this way.
Yeah.
But if she did say you're not manly enough, I mean, that's just like, that's despicable.
It is.
That's like saying to a woman who is, I don't know, having trouble with fertility and saying she's not a good enough woman.
Whoa.
You know what I mean?
It's
like that kind of
yick
talk.
Yep.
And it's just not okay. But we don't know what she was saying. But anyway, going out the email. I keep vacillating back and forth from two contrasting emotions. One, I want to try and win her back and worship the ground she walks on to prove how much I love her. And two, I want to make her so jealous that she regrets leaving me. Sometimes I'll even have this fantasy of us meeting up 5 years down the road and her telling me that she regrets leaving. It's messed up, I know. Mm-hmm. In reality, I just want her back.
Yeah.
So any thoughts on that?
I think those are pretty common, especially when you're really grieving and it's fresh. To imagine scenarios in which you win her back, or you get her esteem, or even, you know, maybe the regret or whatever. I think I've had those fantasies many times, and they are really compelling. And I think that they're just part of the grieving process when you're the one who gets left,
mm-hmm,
and when you really wanted to stay in. And because sometimes people split up and it's, you know, more mutual, not this case.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing, all right, I don't feel 100% comfortable with what I'm about to say. So just think about it carefully before you take any advice from me. But I wonder if it would be useful to accept that it is over. Not that it couldn't come again. I mean, maybe it could, but I don't know if I'd buy that lottery ticket to, you know, cross my fingers. But to just accept that at least right now, it is in the present moment over, as a way of helping you accept reality as it is right now, which is I have found to be very useful. And my clinging to my fantasies about what might have been or what might be just prolonged my suffering. So you can't make yourself believe it if you say it. But saying it is acknowledging the fact that it is indeed over. And I like the present tense verb is, as opposed to you know, any kind of predictions about the future. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I don't know anything about tomorrow, but I know that today it is over. We are broken up, you know? And what my experience with that over time is, it chips away at that tenacious clinging. And then the other thing I want to say is that breakup does not define you. You are you, and that breakup is unfortunate. I met this guy yesterday. I was at a party with a bunch of DBT people who I didn't know. I know one of them, two, the host and then my friend Christina.
Wait, you left the house?
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, that came up at the party. They were talking about how COVID made everybody stay in.
No, you don't do things. You don't do things like that very often.
I don't do this. No.
I'm surprised.
Yeah, I didn't, you know, I had mixed feelings about going, but, you know.
Why? Why'd you go?
Because I wanted to see my friend.
Oh, okay.
I had another friend that was going to be there, didn't show up.
Oh.
And I was just kind of curious.
Okay.
Because I'd never been to Kate's house. It's just Kate's house. Kate's lovely. Anyways, I met...
So it's just a household full of DBT
therapists. DBT therapists, all of whom are strangers to me.
Yeah.
I never met any of them, except for Christina was there, and she brought her partner, Klaus, and he brought his dog, Romeo, cutest dog ever. And since I didn't know anybody, I ended up just talking to Klaus for most of the time I was there, and he's a very fascinating guy. He was telling me he lost his wife to cancer about 2.5 years ago, and he's been in a grief support group, and he sounds like he's just very on it. He's read a lot of books about grieving and grief and loss, and is practicing Buddhism, you know. And what he said was, I'll never be glad it happened, but I am indeed glad for what I learned from it happening. So that's a tricky thing to say, because it's like you could say, you know, you made lemonade out of the lemon, but it sounds like it's disloyal to the honoring the memory of the partner. And he was very clear that it was, he didn't want to lose her. He would have stayed with her forever. And he didn't wish that it happened, but it did happen. And as a result of it happening, he learned something that he wouldn't have learned. What he said was, when she was sick, I was still trying to become a full, he was a professor at the UW, and I was still trying to become a full professor. And before she got sick, that was like, it's a lot of work. You have to publish a lot, write a lot, it's political or whatever. You have to do a lot. And I used to worry about that stuff, right? Is this article going to get published and the feedback I'm getting and da, 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 and all that. And he said, when she was towards the end, when she was in bed, she was mostly unconscious. And I got an email saying that I got full professorship, professorhood, professor. I was a full professor. And she sort of said, oh, good for you. You know, like, but she was sort of in and out of consciousness. And he said, it just doesn't matter. It doesn't, these things don't matter. What really does matter is, you know, this connection that he has with her and, you know, really quite lovely. So I had a fight with Colleen on Saturday night, and I was at this part. We'd made up on Sunday morning. We were like three quarters of the way there. I had a part that I needed to do still. And I really enjoyed talking to him, because I started thinking about the fight that I had and what my contribution was. And I was telling you this before we started today, which is I asked Colleen, I introduced a topic that I know is controversial. No. Provocative for Colleen to talk about. And I didn't acknowledge that. I didn't acknowledge that I was asking her to talk about something that's hard for her to talk about. Not impossible, but just hard and loaded and fills her with a bit of fear. So this morning, that's what I said to her. I said, I'm really sorry. And before, I think I would have said nothing and not thought that I had much to do with the fight, because in the fight, I can pinpoint certain behaviors that she did and say, well, that's why we had a fight. She said this to me and she's a jerk face, blah, 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 blah. Anyways, but I realized that I wasn't acknowledging, you know, that this thing that we were talking about is actually really just bringing it up is provocative for her. And, she said thank you this morning and was glad that I think she was glad that I was acknowledging that, though I think that she wasn't expecting me to do that, which is fine, because it's something I'm learning to do. Is I'm so good at being righteously indignant about the ways in which I'm wronged, and I have a blind spot to recognizing the ways in which I contribute. Some of them are indirect, like I tend to be kind of, you know, avoidant of saying what I want or how I feel. That sets the table, I think, in a sort of a broad way. And then there's the specific conversations we have that lead to conflict, like, for instance, talking about this thing that I know actually is very provocative for her, and not acknowledging that and trying to be supportive of that. And when I went through a breakup, which is what I'm referencing in my head with regard to this email, when I went through a breakup, I had the same kinds of thoughts about how am I going to win her back? And someday she'll regret, you know? Yeah, of course. They're sort of like, they're kind of satisfying in the thing. And I think it's just part of grieving. And I remember I said to her right at the end, nobody's going to love you the way I love you, which, you know, how could anybody know that, right? And in retrospect, I'm like, I had some contributions then. I had bigger blind spots then about how I am and how I am to be with. And I don't have fantasies anymore. I haven't had those for years of, you know, wanting her to be jealous or wanting to get her back or whatever. They don't come into my mind anymore. And I think it's mostly because at the beginning, well, the beginning for me, it was 6 years into the fucking breakup. I started being willing to say, it is over. It is. Because that's, of course, true. That evokes sadness. And I've talked about this here on this podcast before, but also opened the door to really letting it go and not having it haunt me like that.
How did you make that decision, that transition?
I was teaching DBT skills. It's one of the DBT skills. They call it radical acceptance, just acknowledging what is factually true. And I was talking about this in the consult team, and one of the therapists on the team said something to me about, well, it is over, right? And yep, that's true. And I wasn't factually, like, I wasn't denying that fact. What I was denying is, and that means I'll never be happy again, like a prediction. And so what I did is I just started acknowledging that it is over and letting go of any kind of prediction. I don't know what it means, except right now I feel really sad. And also, I'm got to go to Taco Del Mar and get dinner because I'm hungry. But that's it. It doesn't mean that tomorrow it is anything. It might be something, it might not. But I don't know what it is. And the truth is right now it is over.
If you had had that experience 3 years earlier, 3 years into the recovery from the breakup, would you have been able to make that shift?
I think so.
Huh.
Yeah. I can't really know. And grief takes as long as grief takes. And, you know, I mean, I think we still love everybody we ever loved. Doesn't mean we want to be with them, but I don't know. I think I could have if I... It's hard to know. I might not have been in a position where I'd actually be willing to entertain accepting that it's over. I might be able to acknowledge it factually, of course, but...
But to you, it doesn't seem like at the time, 3 years prior, there was a serious barrier that had yet to be pushed aside. It was maybe just the fact that, you know, say after, maybe there's a year where you wouldn't have been possibly able to comprehend the notion.
Yeah.
But after a certain point, you were open to that idea, but had just not been properly exposed to it.
I think that's true. But it's as you say, at the beginning, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You just...
Say 6 months, 18 months, whatever, something like
something
that.
Something like that.
But all that suffering that you endured...
Oh, man. I would do that over again if I could.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm grateful. It's like I said, it's not that I'm glad it happened, and I'm not glad that I went through it, but I am grateful because if it unfolded some other way, I might not have found Colleen.
Yeah.
I'm very grateful for both her and the ways in which I've grown in understanding and in love with her.
Mm-hmm. Well, plus you and that previous woman weren't a good match. I mean, it's just the bottom line.
I was the only one that didn't believe it.
Well, I mean, I didn't say that at the time, but I didn't know it at the time, but after breaking up and hearing more, I was like, oh, well, yeah, you guys were not a good match for each other.
Yeah.
You're different and had different goals, different vibes towards each other, different philosophies of relationship, really.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was intense and there's a lot of emotion back then. But if even with all the therapy and dedication in the world, you'd be way worse off if you had stuck together, the two of you.
Man, we would have probably drove each other nuts.
Yeah, the two of you would have been
each other miserable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... It's, you know, that's the way I see it. It's the story I tell myself. But that's interesting that you could say that, you know, because I think we're prone to say, well, no, I just wasn't ready until that. I needed to go through that. But you're saying, no, I didn't need to go through that. No. It was inevitable, some of it, but I would have enjoyed someone helping me with that earlier. Because, you know, you were teaching DBT prior to that.
I was.
That 6 year point.
Yep.
So you had known this concept.
I did.
But it took some colleague of yours to say something to you. So I'm assuming that you were telling this colleague about your grief and your obsession with your previous partner.
Yeah, I was. Yes, that's exactly what I was doing.
And at this point, you're with Colleen, right?
No. This is about a year before I met her.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's an important milestone in your openness to meeting Colleen
right. and
falling in love. But you had been in relationships in that 6-year point.
That's true.
And, you know, was saying things like exclusivity and that kind of stuff. Yep, anyway,
that's true.
So with this colleague, it's like you set up the fertile ground for that seed to be planted yeah. because you were talking about it and opening up and admitting, yeah. I'm guessing. I'm sure you weren't framing it as a healthy, normal thing that after 6 years you're still pining and hoping and thinking and predict and you know all the thoughts you were predicting that you'd be doomed forever.
Right.
You were still kind of bent out of shape, like yeah. if only she would give me a chance.
The if onlys.
And I still see her car around
oh,
and,
yeah,
and assume that it's
yep,
her.
Yep.
I am still kind of busted up about it. Like it was such a, she broke up with me for stupid reasons. Yeah. How come she can't see the light? I don't understand. You know, so all those, that mindset, yeah. which is totally normal for a time.
Yeah.
But then at some point, it's yeah, accepting yeah. like, oh, well, I just, okay, maybe all those things are true, but right. it's over.
yeah.
And that's that. And I don't know the future. And maybe my predictions about the future aren't accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
So for an anonymous patron, it's like, are you that person for him? Or does he need that person in his life? I don't know.
He's 6 months in or thereabouts.
Is that what he said?
He said she initiated it in April, I think is what he said.
Oh, okay, so yeah.
We're not quite 6 months from, you know, when this is being recorded.
Right.
So it's, I imagine it's all very fresh. And the danger, the thing I wouldn't want to have happen is for that kind of premature
shaming of the self.
Yeah. Like would get in the way of him just being able to process his loss and, you know,
yeah.
like right now, or I would imagine that right now it's a time for take it easy with yourself, self-soothing, support, lots and lots of compassion, which reality acceptance is not, you know, doesn't mean that you're not compassionate, but gently, mm-hmm. gently, because this is really fucking hard. Humans are not made for breakups.
Yeah, this is where I think classic psychoanalysis or the principles actually help, free association specifically.
Yeah.
I did, you know, I've done this with clients, and I have an impulse to do this with clients, and we'll often do it in situations like this because to me, it feels like there's a pressure behind the individual. They know they shouldn't be thinking these thoughts or they think they shouldn't. And their friends and family aren't super yeah. enthusiastic no. about having these conversations.
Right.
So what I do is I, you know, do everything I can to release those bonds and those shackles and say, I might even explain it in this way. It's like, I want you to free associate and just go as far down that road as you want. And there's no judgment from me.
Yeah.
Even if it gets kind of weird, maybe violent, we can talk at the end about, because people will, they'll have violent fantasies about their partners.
Yeah.
And I will at the end say, we understand these are just fantasies and
right.
you're not going to do anything right. And do we need to talk about that?
Yeah.
But it's taboo to even have those thoughts,
right.
let alone talk about
it. We need someone to be able to recognize that and accept, and because we're all kind of, you know, savages inside.
Yeah, and they're just fantasies.
Yeah.
You know, like what he's saying is, I want to make her jealous, okay?
Yeah.
That's a hostile act, right?
It is.
But how big is that hostility and what's going on?
Right.
That's the point that I'm trying to make is that just because you don't say it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Right.
So if the hostility is there and the violent urge is there,
right.
You know, put it out in the light of day.
Yeah.
By all, don't leave it inside of you.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can talk about it, but have some freedom and space to for yourself to just hear yourself speaking out loud and to just let it out, see where it goes.
Right.
And so I'll do that with clients in situation case, you know, just take the, you know, make the plan, whatever you want to talk about. Do you want to make a plan for how to make her jealous? Like, walk yourself through that.
Oh, I like that.
You know, like what would that look like?
Yeah.
And to have that spoken out loud, often the individuals and an honest patron writing this email might, at some point in the email, yeah. he's like, it's messed up, I know. that unless you go through all those thoughts and unearth them and
yeah.
mull them over, it, you know, can really rattle around inside of you. So
right.
it can help. You know, there's a line of entertaining a plan and becoming obsessed with the plan. You know, there are avenues that one, a clinician would have to watch out for, which I do.
Yeah.
But I find that people are way too paranoid about this sort of thing. You know, I'll have a client that will tell me that
right.
they have massive PTSD. You know, they were sexually abused by their dad for 10 years and they have this fantasy. They were on a date and this guy sort of triggered her with with the trauma, and she had this fantasy of stabbing him 20 times and was alarmed by that and thought there was something wrong with her. Long story short, after doing an assessment of risk, I determined there wasn't any risk. It was a violent fantasy designed to give her power on the inside,
right.
and to help her feel safe.
Yeah.
And I encouraged her to tell me more about all those fantasies, and she had a lot of them, actually.
Yeah.
And someone would walk out in front of her car, jaywalk in Seattle, and she would just have this flash of just taking that person, you know, I won't describe, but, you know, sure. very, very vivid,
yeah.
violent, bloody, humiliating, you know, disturbing images. But if you can't talk about them with your therapist, then what the fuck are we doing
what
here?
What are we doing?
Yeah. So I was like, yeah, you know, that's, how does that make you feel to think about that? Mm-hmm. Why do you think you feel that way?
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel to tell me about it? So, you know, I'm not saying that's what an honest patient is thinking. He's not talking about any kind of violence, but, you know, I wouldn't be surprised. The pain and the vindictiveness, it runs deep. Yeah. And as you said, we're savages, we're animals, and we're capable of having those kinds of thoughts.
Right.
But they're just thoughts within reason.
There's that chapter, Fat Lady from Love's Executioner, Irv talks about that very much. He said he was in his own analysis, his training analysis with a lady called Olive Smith. And, you know, an analysis, the therapist doesn't do much overt. They're listening, they're tracking, but it's a lot of free association. He said, I expressed some monstrous feelings towards my mother. And in all the 600 years I spent with Olive Smith, this was the most helpful thing she said. She leaned over the couch and she said, that's just the way we're made. And he ended up saying that to the client in the Fat Lady story.
Oh, Olive Smith was his analyst.
Oh. Yeah. And so he said that.
So start over. So he's talking about, he's recalling in his head as he's talking to this client.
Right.
About his own analyst, Olive, who was trying to help him with his own stigma about his own what?
Monstrous feelings towards my mother is what he called it.
Okay.
I don't recall him being specific about what they were. Just that they were monstrous feelings, and she just leaned over the couch and reassuringly said to him, that's just the way we're made.
And leaned over the couch, meaning that it was classic psychoanalysis?
Yeah.
Meaning that she was out of view.
Yeah.
And she, in a rare move, yep. leaned into his field of view and said,
that's just the way we're made.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah.
And he said those words were so healing and restorative, and he ended up, because the client in the Fat Lady thing had some kind of fantasy about her father. Something, I think it was violent, but I can't remember.
Yeah.
And he just said to her, that's just the way we're made.
Yeah.
And he said, I could see her. She took a breath and she just relaxed.
Yeah.
Like it was okay. So I agree with you. If we're not, assessing, yes, okay, fine. But if we're not a place where people can talk about the monstrous stuff inside and know that it's safe, know that there's us, we're there to contain it with them. And accept it, and, you know, no judgment. There's no need to have a judgment.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the messy is really clean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not only non-judgment, but a philosophy that's the way we're made.
That's the way we're made.
And that's one of the beauties of psychoanalysis that isn't necessarily a major theme in other contemporary ways of being a therapist. Mm-hmm. You know, I come from a time, and we come from a time when I think analysis was much more prevalent in the philosophies. You know, we didn't learn analysis, but a lot of the mindset today, you probably don't know this necessarily, but you probably know a little bit of it. But I experienced this a lot more in my university because there's a lot of younger, newer folks who have the contemporary way of thinking about who we are and what our professional duties are. And as we have progressed as a field, as a bunch of professions in mental health, we have become more and more punitive to therapists for not taking action, which I think is a good thing, but you know, like duty to protect and tear us off and that kind of stuff. And also not having sex with your clients and dual role and all this constant talk about ethical violations that is mostly wrongheaded on the internet. But I feel like 30, 40, 50 plus years ago, and when we were being trained about 30 years ago, can you imagine? We're coming up on our 30-year anniversary of meeting each other in 1995 at Antioch University.
Yeah.
Pretty bizarre, right?
Very.
And so I think that, and so my experience of that was this slow, reluctant transition for myself, because, you know, as a professor and as a supervisor, teacher, I had to adopt a lot of that way of thinking and or at least get to know it. And I'm okay with it, but I still hold on to this streak of therapy as a place for people to be able to just go anywhere without worry of any kind of consequence.
I agree.
Of course, you know, there's a quote unquote within reason at the end of that, right? That I'll often say suicidality, homicidality, abuse of children, this sort of stuff.
We do have a duty to actually protect.
Yeah. But I even remember learning in the mid 90s about even the mandated reporting of child abuse. And I remember thinking, and I would only have thought this if it was in the air, the zeitgeist, or if it was told to me or something. Because what would I know about any of this? I had no knowledge of any. You had some knowledge of behind-the-scenes therapy before you came into graduate school. I had no knowledge. I didn't even know what empathy was, as we've talked about.
Right.
It was a new word for me
at
the age of 24. And so I was, I remember thinking when I learned about our the law in, I think, all of the United States, for us mental health individuals and also teachers and physicians, that if we hear about child abuse, we have to report it.
Right.
I remember thinking, well, yeah, absolutely, as an option, but I don't like that restraint because that could actually hinder a client's ability to share with me about what they have experienced or what they have done.
Right.
And I want to make that call. I don't want legislatures to be in the therapy office, because that's a sacred place, confidential, safe place for people to say whatever, worse things than even that, maybe, right? Well, it's hard to imagine worse than that, but you know what I'm saying? Like pretty horrendous. I come from the mindset, or I was influenced heavily by people that believe that to be true, such that even mandated reporting felt invasive. But today, there's so many more things that are mandated-ish to us as mental health people, and it just continues to pile and up more and more. You know, I understand it, and I'm for it.
Yeah.
But I at the same time, I think we should hold on to that philosophy and that influence of analysis and free association and freedom for the therapy to go wherever it's going to go. You can do both for sure, but I don't know I haven't heard a lot of contemporary folks speaking this way, novice clinicians, current trainers, professors. I don't hear that. If anything, I just hear either they say Freudian stuff is all bullshit or they don't even know what Freudian stuff is. It's like so far removed from our lives that they just don't even... They're not even aware. It's like, huh? I seem to remember we're learning about Freud and Psych 101 during my undergrad, but I don't really know much about it. And that's fine, I guess. But anyway,
that's lost, though, the tradition or the recognition that, you know, monstrous feelings exist. If we don't even want to call them that, they're normal.
Yeah.
And it's important that we're not afraid of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Freud and analysis, that was a huge theme and pro to the model and the mindset, this assumption, really. And, of course, they would take it too far at times.
That's true.
Like Melanie Klein, often object relationist, would think that infants wanted to have sex with their parents. Like, she would take it really far.
Really weird.
Yeah. And it, so once you start going in that road, unless you have some sort of barrier, some sort of editor, you could end up thinking that everyone is constantly thinking the most monstrous fantasy.
Right.
But the openness to the monstrous fantasy and the considering yourself as a clinician,
right,
as a healer, as someone who actually, it, your purpose is to help people to be able to unearth and describe and mull over their monstrous fantasies.
Yeah.
That's a big part of analysis, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, actually, before moving on, let's take another break. What do you say, Bob?
Yeah, let's take a break.
Okay, we're back from the break. So getting back to the anonymous patron email, he has a couple questions. Have you guys had these types of emotions during a breakup? I think we've answered that.
Yeah.
Bonus question, is there a treatment modality that works best for people going through separations? Bob, what do you think? Like this?
I don't know. I kind of want to defer to you. Is there?
Well, we talked about DBT,
yeah,
which, you know, is helpful for everyone. And,
yeah,
and there's probably particular modules like acceptance, radical acceptance,
yeah,
that could help. Also, we talked about analysis, but mainly it's attachment, which should be of no surprise to people. What I hear, anonymous patron, I don't know your history, but you met when you were 20, which is young. It might feel old, but it was young. And from 20 to 27, you're with her, you get married, you plan on spending the rest of your life with her.
Mm-hmm.
Well, really at any age, but I think it could be particularly rough when you're younger, right? And the neurons that have been oriented toward her, that's the way I describe it, because that's the way I think of it. We tend to think of these things as like, well, you think and you feel, but we're talking about the brain, and we develop habits, like the fact that you can very quickly get into the car and turn it on and drive down the road without having to think about it is because you've practiced and practiced and practiced so many times that your neurons have wired such that you don't have to think about it. It's just an automatic movement. The fact that I can say all these sentences and move hundreds of muscles within my diaphragm and my face and my tongue and my larynx and, you know, my cheeks is the fact that I have spent so much time practicing how to speak and how to articulate and how to think and speak at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's neurons that are connecting and being more robust with continued firing. What wires together is the point. And when you were with her for 7 years, yeah, particularly when your brain is still forming, right? Mm. And your brain is always sort of forming, so to speak, but, you know, 20-25 is still in that plastic zone. You are, and it's not like at 25 it just drops off the face of the earth, but I hope you get what I'm saying. Your brain fired with your wife. Your wife had all the associations of love and attachment and security and sexuality and friendship, and she's there, and she's there in the morning, she's there at night, and you hear her walking down the stairs, and you hear her breathing, you feel her touch, you smell her hair. Mm-hmm. Everything is just constantly being firing in your brain, and those neurons are just constantly being bigger and more robust and stronger, and then suddenly she's gone.
Oh.
And your brain is still firing.
Yeah.
Where is she? What's happening? It's neuronal. It's biological. So the fact that you're 6 months later, yeah, still busted up about it is a physical, biological thing. There's no getting around that. Your brain wants her back. Your brain is saying, we need her. Mm-hmm. It's not an addiction. It's just normal human attachment, normal human brain biology. And that's just the way it's going to be. The other thing I'll say is that your way of reacting to it is common, but the flavor is particular to you.
Yeah.
Everyone has things in this camp, but it's your issue. You know what I mean? It's not hers. It's the way that you're reacting. Like, you know, you're trying to win her back. You want to make her jealous. Of course, there's literally a billion people on the planet, if or more, who have had those thoughts at some point. But my point is that you have a lot to learn about yourself and how you defend against attachment loss.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that can be learned from that and observed. It's not an automatic thing. It's something that you can actually differentiate from and analyze to some extent. You know, what am I trying to get is maybe the thing to ask yourself. By making her jealous and winning her back, what am I trying to achieve? Because you might think consciously you're trying to achieve her back, but really what you might be trying to achieve might be something else. Obviously, attachment security is one, but it also might be things like humiliation. You know, there's a lot of humiliation in being dumped, especially divorced, right? Mm. Because you publicly declared to the world and in a ceremony and family and rings being exchanged and money being spent on flowers and invitations. And it wasn't that long ago, I'm guessing, that you got married.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a humiliation aspect to it. There's a demeaning aspect to it. Like, how this is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And so looking at what it is you're trying to heal by having her back is actually a huge question, because there's a likelihood that you can't solve these things by actually getting her back,
mm-hmm.
but that you can solve these things by focusing on meeting those needs. You know, if it's humiliation or something, like, what is it? What sort of healing do you need to have around that? I mean, you could literally even ask her if this is what it is, humiliation, you could literally even ask her to make a post that praises you if she's up for it, just so that maybe some of the humiliation isn't as bad. You know, of course, within reason, don't force her to do anything.
Oh,
but
yeah.
But these kinds of things can help. You know, if you're dumping someone and you see them hurting, you know, there's things you might be able to do to assist these things, depending. But anyway, yeah. So, you know, attachment-based therapy and getting strong attachments to replace the attachment that you had with your wife is probably good. You mentioned in the email you cite, you know, DBT, CBT, person-centered gestalt. Yeah, you know, all those are probably, I don't know if I'd do CBT, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, it couldn't hurt, but that wouldn't be the majority of what I would do. Person-centered could do a lot. Gestalt mm-hmm. could do a lot. But most of all, an honest patron, you know, it's rough, and I'm sorry mm-hmm. you're going through this.
Yeah.
I hope you feel that Bob and I understand the enormity of this and how rough it is, and how it's possible that a lot of people aren't appreciating how rough it is for you.
Right.
And, you know, like you were saying earlier about Klaus telling you about his wife dying, and
yeah,
that is an apt analogy.
Yeah.
It is a death of a relationship.
Right.
And for some, I even say it's worse, because it's awful to say this, but when cancer takes someone, you can blame the cancer. In this situation, the person you love and want back is the one who decided to leave you.
Yeah.
I do hear something promising, anonymous patron, in your narrative. You say that the reasons why she wanted to leave were confusing to you. But overall, you say, I think she just fell out of love with me. And as she started to grow as a person, you know, think 20 to 27, as she started to grow as a person, she, what she wanted from me and what she wanted from the relationship changed.
Yeah.
That's a really charitable and possibly very accurate narrative about what had happened. Most people in your position, I'd be more worried about you if you had a sort of narrative like, she's confused, she doesn't know what she wants, some sort of critical thing, some sort of judgmental thing about her. or she was influenced by her mom who never liked, you know, those kinds of things.
Right.
Because most of the time when someone breaks up with you, it's because, yeah, they just fell out of love with you, and they might have their reasons. They might come up with a story as to why they fell out of love with you. But, you know, love is weird, and it's hard to talk about. It's hard to quantify.
Oh, yeah.
Hard to know. I mean, how do we know, you know, like, why did I fall in love with Stacy? I could put it into a whole book of descriptions, but it wouldn't really be satisfyingly scientific and factual, right? Another person could come along just like Stacy, and I could have had a very similar set of interactions and be absolutely repulsed by that person. You know, we have our stories that we tell, and I'm not saying it's supernatural. I'm just saying it's just out of our awareness. We just can't really put our finger on these kinds of things, you know?
Right.
Why did we choose the career that we have? You know, we could say that there's a story there, but how do, you know, it's probably way beyond us to even comprehend how we come to those decisions. But anyway,
yeah.
So I'm encouraged by that, because that says that you have differentiation and you are further down the road than a lot of people in your position. But yeah, the last little thing I'll say is that point where you can say to yourself, I have now crossed the threshold. I have already crossed the threshold, but I've been holding on to the fantasy that I have not crossed the threshold. I mean, we don't know what that threshold is, as you were saying. Maybe you do get back together in the future, but you have crossed some sort of massive threshold. A divorce is happening, and that is a threshold. And the fantasy that you haven't crossed the threshold is normal and understandable, but is causing additional suffering. It's not like once you let go of that fantasy, your suffering is going to end. It will continue for the rest of your life. You will suffer from this divorce the rest of your life, in all likelihood, even though you're only 27.
Yeah.
Like, you'll be 57, and in all likelihood, it'll hurt you. So that will happen, and that sucks, but it'll be a lot less over time. And I really hope that you have people you're talking to.
Yeah.
I have a feeling you do, which is good. But anyway, let's take a break. When we get back, let's answer more emails. What do you say?
Yeah.
All right, we're back from the break. So this next email, let's do an OPP,
right?
Actually, it's been a while. So these folks became patrons all the way back in 2021. These are all monthly deserving listeners. We have Unera from Ottawa. We have Deborah from New Mexico, Rio Rancho, Mexico. That sounds like out of a Western movie or something. Stella out of Australia, New South Wales. Aaron from Salem, Oregon. Laxtrative from San Diego. Rebecca from San Francisco. Lana from Norway. I was going to say New Orleans. N-O, Norway. And Nicole from Santa Monica, California. Claire from Cedral Woolley, Washington.
Oh.
You been to Cedral Woolley?
Once.
Greta from Shoreline, which is just near here.
Near me.
Yeah. Rachel from, you're like a 2 blocks from Shoreline, aren't
5 blocks south of Shoreline, yeah.
Greta from Shoreline. Rachel from St. Petersburg, Florida. Liam from Staten Island, New York. Linda from Stockholm, Sweden. Julie from Sunnyvale, California. And Mariah from Sutter Creek, California. Thank you for becoming a patron and staying a patron all the way from 2021, which is just amazing. You pay my bills. Literally, you do. This next email is from another patron, Balas, who is a good friend of the podcast. He says, how can I help people? I want to change the world, or maybe just a small portion of it. I have no plan and no particular skills or money to do this. The best thing I could come up with was being a therapist, but I'm not good at learning stuff. Bob, what do you think?
Dude, that sounds like you. You're 24, you're driving across the bridge, and you're like, how can I help?
Yeah.
What can I do to make a contribution?
Mm-hmm.
And you became a therapist, so obviously Bala should do that, right? Well, what are you passionate about? What are you interested in? What turns you on? Like, is there like a cause? Saving the environment, or an oppressed group, or working for social justice, or setting a personal goal of just being kind to the people that you come in contact with, which that's one of my favorites. Mm. We were at the Tractor and Supply, I told you this, and there's a kid selling, he's a Cub Scout or a Boy Scout.
To be clear, you're not buying actual tractors.
No.
You're just buying fire clothes.
Yeah,
oh, fire logs?
Fire logs, and then we ended up with the jacket I wore today, yeah. So he's selling this stuff, like caramel corn and stuff like that, like Girl Scout cookies, but not the cookies. And so I'm looking at it, just several different things there, and I said, which one's the best one? And he points at that one, and I'm like, okay, how much is that? He goes, $25 for about a 15-ounce bag of caramel corn.
Jesus!
I know.
Well, so they're raising money for a charity?
For scouts. He's a scout. I don't know what they're raising money for. I presume it's to support his troop or
25 the... bucks?
Yeah.
For a bag?
I know.
Is it flaked with gold?
No. It is pretty good, though. I'll say that. But it is ridiculously priced. So, okay. I don't really care about that. So... he says, yeah, that one's good. Okay, so we'll take that one. And then what else? And I'm like, how about this one? And he's like, yeah, that one's $15. Okay, I said to him, all right, we're going to buy them both, and I'm only going to take the one. And then the other one you give away to whoever you want. Mm. And he's like, so I could take it. I'm like, yep, you are someone who might want it. You give it away. That's fine. And he's just looking at me like I was being... you know, like I grew a third head or something. I only have the one anyways, but I don't think that the humans are all that accustomed, or at least the Americans I see are all that accustomed to kindness in an everyday world, you know, like just in an everyday world. I love doing that stuff because A, it's fun to kind of play with the kid. He was a lovely little kid. And B, I want to send a message. I wish to offer that to the universe. And, you know, I'm only going to, how many people do you think in your lifetime you will actually cross paths with? Mm-hmm. And don't count, the internet doesn't count. Just like walking around in the world. Mm-hmm. Maybe 10,000, maybe 15. I don't even know. Yeah, I wouldn't even know where to begin. But if I can do that, then I've done something. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's like that one's an important one, a way to contribute. Mm-hmm. To me.
Yeah.
Plus we go in the store and Colleen's like, you're such a kind man. I feel so lucky to be with you. And I was like, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really nice.
Yeah, very nice. It was lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I like that. Ballas, you could do that. Also, I'll add a common mission in life is to have kids, have a family.
Yeah.
Be able to give to those children or to your own pets.
Right.
You don't have to change the world. You can change one creature and make that your mission and feel very good about it. But the thing that I know about you, Ballas, is that you do use social media well, so you could lean into that skill. You say you don't really have particular skills, but I do know that you have skills with social media, so I would count yourself different than others in that way that you could use. But yeah, the other thing that I would, in line with what Bob was saying, is instead of saying, I want to change the world, ask yourself, what change do you want to make? Because yeah, there's so many changes one could do to the world.
Right.
And what fires you up? What are you passionate about? Because that's necessary to carry you through all the bullshit along the way. Along the lines of what Bob was saying, brainstorm, you know, and then once you come up with a list, start going through some pros and cons just without poo-pooing any idea.
Yeah. You know? That's the trick to a brainstorm. You poo-poo nothing.
Right. Because you say, well, I could become a therapist, but I'm not good at learning stuff. That, but I'm not good at learning stuff is not a good way to brainstorm.
No.
You could note that as a con. It's not likely true though. Plus, mm-hmm, I'll tell you, at least in my neck of the woods, to graduate with a master's in counseling or therapy, you don't have to be a genius. You might think you do, but that's all put down to students. But
no.
As a professor, take it from me. There's a bell curve of IQ, and I have taught students who I perceived as having a lower than typical average IQ of a particular student. You know, I don't know what, I never did a study, but I'm guessing that the bell curve trends higher than the average bell curve of IQ. So I don't know what would be on, you know, one or two standard deviations away from the mean for a graduate student in Antioch. But but I'll say that some of these students, you know, were, it took them longer to learn things, but as long as they were humble and tried hard and worked at it, a lot of what it is to be a therapist doesn't involve being a genius, honestly. No. It involves a lot of emotional intelligence and having good mentors and being humble and being observant of the self. These things don't require you to understand string theory. So so I wouldn't worry about that. And some programs are more along those lines than others. But I find, the at least in my neck, our neck of the woods, the vast majority of master's programs are pretty light in the academic rigor. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Doctorates are different, but depending even in that category. And I think that's a good thing, because we're training people who can do the job, not people who pass the SATs. You know, like for us at Antioch, we don't even use the GREs, which is the standard test that people take in the United States to get into graduate school, because there's no data to support, and anecdotally as well, there's no data to support that if we screen students based on GRE, that we get better therapists in the end, because there's in fact there's data showing that that association is not there.
Wow.
Along those lines, when we would review applications, we including me would not look at grades very closely. We would look at it, and someone that got a lot of A's, it was encouraging, but someone that got a lot of C's or D's in their undergrad, you know, it wasn't, it was like, well, let's meet them and see how they think and what went on there. Maybe I'll ask them what happened with these grades. But especially if they got a D in like calculus in college, like what's the difference there? Who cares?
Yeah.
So if anything, but if they got D's in writing, it was like, well, you might have a hard time actually going through the program. But even then, I had students that were terrible writers. And some, you know, I won't mention names, but some of the best therapists I've ever trained and worked with as a supervisor were not good at writing papers. They were very below average in their ability to describe things in paragraph, essay, academic paper form. And who gives a fuck, though? If they actually change lives, which they do, then I'm here for it. Yeah. And I will overlook the occasional APA format problem to get that person the training and in the position where they can actually save the world, which they're doing.
Right.
So, you know, you find a good enough professor that sees that, then, you know, things work out. But the way you phrase it is that the best I could come up with was being a therapist. That doesn't sound very encouraging for one's need of passion for therapy. Maybe that will grow. I'm not saying it's not, but and maybe, Ballas, you kind of mean it that way. But there's, you know, as Bob says, there's so many other things.
Yeah.
There's activism. There's being kind to a Boy Scout, that sort of thing. The other thing that I kind of hear, it was a longer email, Ballas, so I didn't read the whole thing. But the kind of thing I was sort of hearing was this focus on making a difference. Mm-hmm. And for me, this is just me, is that was never my focus. I was never focused on making a difference. I was focusing on trying to make a difference. And there's a big difference there, because I don't depend on the difference happening, but I do depend on me trying. Yeah. I do have control over that. The other thing is that I started small, not because I was headed to something big, but because I just, that's what occurred to me, I guess. And when I was 24 years old and stuck in traffic and thinking, how do I make a change in the world? What do I want to do? I want something that's, I want a career that actually makes a difference, that feels fulfilling. The vision I had was I was sitting in a room with one person, and I didn't know what that meant. I didn't initially think that was therapy. Mm. I thought it was some other kind of, I was grasping it. So in my head, I'm like, I want to be in a room with one person where we talk about things. Mm. And of course, it's therapy, but that did not occur to me.
No, you were, there was a raw vision.
Yeah. I was thinking like, some sort of guide or a consultant or something. Yeah. And teacher was another thing that popped in my head. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you teach, but you also meet with students alone. Like high school music teacher was a huge thing on my short list of careers.
I can see that.
But I didn't really want to corral kids, you know. I didn't want to have to discipline kids or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I just kept thinking that all of a sudden therapist popped in my head, and it all made all sense in the world. And so I started with that. Like, I want to make a difference in one person's life. And then later on, I started teaching and supervising. So I was making a difference in the people that make a difference. And then I start teaching professors and supervisors. I start supervising supervisors, and I start supervising professors. So that's another broadening out. And then now I'm on the internet. So 30 years into it, that's where I'm at. But I started small and attainable and humble, I guess, in a way. I'm not calling myself humble. I'm saying that, you know, if you do have a goal of whatever it is that you come to, Balas, like you want to make this difference, when I work with people and mentor people, I will encourage them to think about what you can do this year in that direction. You know, what's something you can do now? And it's great, because what I find a lot of people do is they want this big goal, and that's great. Keep your eyes forward, mm-hmm. keep your eye on the ball. But if that's all you look at, you'll never get there, because you're not actually building the pathway to get there. Yeah. So what can you do now that's along those lines? You know, it depends on the goal, but, you know, like if you want to, I don't know, spread the notion that climate change is real or something, you know, and you want to change governments and policy, and you want large groups of non-believers to understand the science. Well, okay, but the chance of being able to get that much clout overnight is not really there. So what can you do tomorrow? Maybe there's literally one person that you can talk to and have a conversation with and learn something, or write a paper about it, or publicize it, or something. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, Bob, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle, in which we answered at length, I would say, some of the patron emails. Yep. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because
you deserve it.